We'll talk a little bit about symbols. Symbols in our modern society don't seem to play as important part as they appear to have done in medieval cultures or ancient cultures, but whether we know it or not, they're equally important. We respond to symbols, sometimes without recognizing that they are symbols. Matter of fact, this is the way man communicates. Even though we might rely more on verbal symbols today, at least as far as our awareness is concerned, we still stop at stop signs, we still go where the arrow points, we still respond to red and green, and hopefully go in the right restroom. So we still live by these visual means of communication. And certainly the church, at least, has tried to even preserve these and say we put up a certain kind of symbol and you should respond in a certain predictable way. You should be reminded of something. Actually, the church has little choice, I think, but to continue to rely on symbols consciously. And therefore, I think it's the church's business and obligation to consider these rather seriously. What are they trying to do? I've seen catalogs or books on symbols, like a dictionary, many of them historical types, which may or may not have been valid at one time, but really have little relevance to what's happening today. I think symbols such as a triangle to depict the Trinity are quite meaningless. To try to make them mean something is to force the issue. I think, on the other hand, that the sign that someone gave this morning has more pertinence in our time and perhaps more meaning, as it grew out of a real situation, as all symbols did at one time. And therefore, if they no longer have a direct connection to what we think and believe, it's like a word, they become obsolete. And it becomes artificial, it becomes arbitrary rather to try to preserve them. But religion has another problem, that it deals with metaphysical ideas. Now, here's where words reveal their limitations. There are many concepts, many ideas, which can only be symbolized, that can only be alluded to with marks. They're not only a very efficient way, but they can suggest ideas, such as the resurrection, which is incomprehensible. I think the formula of the Holy Trinity is also incomprehensible, and here even the symbol, I think, fails to communicate it. But at least it can allude to it. Also, man has a almost desperate desire for the tangible. Bishop Robinson wrote a book where he tries to break down some of the so-called myths, religious myths such as God up there, the medieval cosmos idea of the levels of the universe is hell down here, earth here, heaven above. I really think it's all a waste of time, because anyone who's taken this matter seriously is in trouble already. I don't think his book is going to save one. That is, to think of God as the old man with the rippling muscles and the long white beard sitting on a cloud up there throwing thunderbolts down from Mount Olympus. Of course, it's a Zeus image. It came directly from Greek mythology, as did the Christ figure, as the very finely chiseled features, with front chiseled features, and the broad hairless chest emerging from the toga with the cock knee. It's a typical Apollo approach to a divine personage. Man has this desire, and he insists upon putting religious ideas in a physical concrete form. And even God himself appears to recognize the idiosyncrasies of his creation, because when he appears to man, he appears as a pillar of fire, the Holy Spirit as a bird with the wings flapping, a very tangible, very real ways. If one reads in the Bible, talking with God, you know, the voice from heaven, it just doesn't really make too much sense. But we have to some way identify God. Not to get involved in a theological point, but it seems to me that this makes the person of Jesus Christ extremely important. as we can identify this person and his work. We can't God, but we still insist on trying. So this is another value of the symbol. At least it can allude to some of these very abstract ideas, and they are indeed abstract. Another problem, though, that the church has today is an attempt not only to preserve obsolete symbols, but to try to rely upon commonly accepted symbols. I think the two are related. I frequently work with building committees, and they say, you know, we want to do some kind of symbolic development here, but it's something everybody has to understand. You know, that may make some sense at first, but if you stop and think about it, it makes no sense at all. It's like saying in the first grade, all right, children, we will not attempt to teach you anything you do not already know. So you let me know how much you know, and then the course will run accordingly or be conducted accordingly. See, symbols are a way of communicating, and as such, they are involved in the whole pedagogical process of the church. But also, I think it's a symptom of the church trying to find or reduce everything to a common denominator. I think the site should be set a little higher. I think that what is common bond among people should be their common aspirations, their common ultimate concerns, their ideals. And symbols can point to this. I think there are a great many things being done today which are an attempt to bring a little vitality into this. Again, back to this kind of thing. They are being invented. They are being used. And hopefully a way to point to these ultimate concerns and not to hark back to a few very trite and rather meaningless common symbols. Another problem is that few churches are ready to abandon their visual cliches because it becomes a mark of identity. It becomes a badge. I think this has happened to some degree in architectural expression, and we've talked about this in the evening for many reasons. One is that we're breaking down ethnic groupings, so we don't have to worry too much about, say, what a Lutheran church looks like or a Presbyterian church looks like, but we still attempt to hang on to some of our symbols. These symbols have become, I think, religious objects, holy objects, relics, which is, of course, a very definition of idolatry. For example, Salzman's Head of Christ. I've mentioned this before, I mentioned again this connection that there are people who actually believe that Christ set for this portrait. You know, he came down and knocked on Salzman's door. That's where he got the one painting, Christ knocking on the door, I guess. And he let him in, and he sat and had him do his portrait. I never met Mr. Salzman, but I did meet and know a friend of his, and he denies this, of course. But people attach this significance. I imagine he's probably a very sincere man, just a rather poor painter. I know that. As a matter of fact, how I met his friend, I spoke once to a group of college-age people, a men's honorary society, to which he was the advisor. And we talked about art in many connections and art in the church. And I made the comment that this particular painting, if it is to be of Christ, I find a little bit offensive because at best it is a mother image, and perhaps at worst it depicts our Lord as a homosexual. And you'd be surprised at these grown men, you know, crying. I hate to see a man cry. It really shattered them that I would say this, because, you know, they think that I'm addressing myself directly to Jesus of Nazareth, and I'm not. I'm just looking at a painting which will pass off into oblivion in a few years. As I said, it isn't a very good painting technically. Certainly, it is not any kind of masculine treatment of the subject. It is effeminate by any standard. But because we give a kind of holy definition to it, we're afraid to look at it critically. I think if it depicted Lyndon Johnson, We could look at it quite critically. We have no problem seeing that what has been done here. I think that a portrait is not a viable possibility anyway. You can't do a portrait of Jesus. A painter, if he's going to get involved in this kind of thing, seems to me, can deal with what he did, but not what he looked like. The problem here, of course, is that the form is confused with the ideas. And if an action is presented, if something that he did is presented, then the meaning of that action becomes uppermost in the presentation. And not whether or not, in fact, we've talked about this before, the real great problems that the artists have had down through the centuries about which way Jonah was swallowed by the great fish. If he went in feet first, he could come out head first, which is more dignified than if he was swallowed head first and had to come out feet first. And they had to settle this so that when they depicted it, you would know whether it was going in or coming out. You know, all these real big problems of trying to worry about how a thing looked and how historical it was. I think that the idea is more important, like Bibles with fake leather bindings and fancy gilt edges. And if what do you do with these old Bibles? You know, you throw them in the garbage can. One begins to put this object on a pedestal rather than the ideas contained in it. I think this is past now, but it wasn't long ago when every Bible had to have this kind of treatment. You know, if you can imagine taking a Bible, tearing out a page, and making a paper airplane out of it and sailing it across the classroom, as I've done on occasion to prove a point, it shocks people. And yet it was printed on a dirty printing press, and the guy who put it together had dirt in his fingernails. You know, there's nothing holy about the object itself. But we're all hung up, in large extent, with idolatrous ideas, whether we know it or not, even in our modern age. I think that the churches have to recognize what our symbol is in order to make them meaningful to our modern time. I think also to get rid of the superstition, which we've all grown up with, we have to find symbols that relate to our own time. Just briefly, a comment about art and religion. I think there's a natural alignment here, because both are basic to the human condition. Art and religion are very closely related, because they both deal very much with private things, very personal things with people, the reality of their individual existences. André Malraux, the French philosopher of art and the minister for culture of France, advisor to Le Grand Charles, wrote this in his Metamorphoses of the Gods. What we would now, and I quote, what we would now name creative power was initially the power of giving form to that which made the human animal become man. If he had not set up against appearance his successive worlds of truth, he would not have become a rational being, but another ape. Here we have to define, I'm not going to get into this because it's a rather deep subject, the difference between a sign, a signal, and a symbol. But nowhere in art are you dealing with the actual object. In other words, if you make a sculpture of a human figure, it is never the human figure. Sometimes sculptors have been intrigued and been at times have dealt with this idea of illusions of reality, if I may use the term in a common usage. That is, to do a piece of sculpture of a bench and like this, and then sit down and it's made out of marble. In fact, Bellini, slips my mind. This hour of the morning I can appreciate why it would slip my mind. But there's a neoclassic sculptor who did a reclining figure on a couch on a chaise longue. It's in a museum in Rome, and the pillows, like it was satin, they squash in, you know. And there's a rope around it to keep people out, but I snuck in just out of curiosity to sit on it. And it's a shocking experience to find the chaise longue and it feels cold and it's hard. It's that much an illusion. It's really a fantastic job of carving. But it is essentially a joke. It's a fun thing. Because what, and as Malraux says, what makes a human is his ability, what makes a rational person, is his ability to give forms to ideas, worlds of truth. There are sort of a predictable cycle. There is a predictable cycle that man has gone through and is going through. He seems to do this periodically. Building up to this point, first of all, man develops a conception of the object as tool. If you go out into the woods, as perhaps most of you have up here, and you run across adverse weather conditions, you attempt to build some kind of shelter. Well, let's say you were stranded there, like Robinson Crusoe, for years at a time. We could go through this as a question and answer, but to save time, I'll answer for you. The next step would be to develop this into a more reasonable environment for yourself, a more comfortable environment. And the next step would be to develop the aesthetic. That is, you would then worry about what the thing looked like and how it related to its landscape or its tree, if you were up in a tree, like Robinson Crusoe is supposedly. This is the cycle of man which he has always gone through, that we go first of all from the conception of the object as tools, and this is what makes the ape a higher animal than the others, is that he can conceive of an object as a tool, and no other animal can. That is, if there's a banana up there, he can't climb the tree, and there's a stick here, you pick up the stick and knock the banana down. No other animal will do that. But that's his highest level. Man, on the other hand, can not only knock the banana down, but he can go farther. At least some men can. And the next one is refinement to maximum efficiency. Now, say that the stick had stumps all over it, or prickly things or whatever, and you hit the banana and it punctured it. Well, that's no good. The banana comes down and it's all smashed. Well, man, very smart, he will take a stone and he'll knock these things off. He'll smooth the stick down so when he knocks the banana off, it works very efficiently and it comes down in a fairly complete form. The next step is refinement to form in itself. So while he's sitting there, he's eating the banana, he's got the stick in his hand, and he has nothing better to do, so he's taking the stone and he's making a little hook on the end of it. And the hook is modulated, and it's interesting. He likes to feel it. He's beginning to develop the aesthetic. And the final thing is, then he sees this as, oh, that reminds him of a deer or something. So put horns on it, and this becomes then symbolic, has symbolic meaning. And then he's reached his highest level of understanding or thinking. Now, earlier in the week, there have been discussions about philosophers' approach to what is reality and what is symbol, except the word symbol I don't think was used. At least I didn't hear it. And I'm not going to get involved in splitting hairs at this point. Use a symbol in a broad sense. As something which, an object, a form of some sort that represents an idea. An idea. And this is what makes man, man. When you're hung up on art in terms of a reproduction of nature, you do not understand what it means to be man. Art has to be man-made. You can't pick up an object off of the beach and say this is art. It is not. It has nothing really to do with man. It's part of his environment, certainly, but nothing with which he's had direct relationship with. Rather, if you took up a stone off the beach and you started piling one upon another, then you're acting like a man. Sometimes this isn't good, particularly if you're stacking beer cans one on top of each other out in the wilderness. No matter where you go, it seems you find an empty beer can. But this is at least man being man. Maybe he has to modify his attitude somewhat. And this is the cycle we go through in developing from a very basic manner of thinking to the highest level of thinking, where we get to the symbol. And now there are many kinds of symbols. And this is, I think, helpful in identifying the ones that we come in contact with every day. First of all, a symbol can be an emblem or a sign. You're going to have an implied rather than an explicit meaning. Well, for example, if you have a cup, now admittedly we don't use this shape of cup for too many things nowadays, but because it's a common and recognizable symbol, we'll keep this shape. It has little or no significance. It has no context. However, if you put some kind of sign with an implied meaning, you now have context. You now have said this is a chalice for the celebration of Holy Communion. A Buddhist wouldn't know that, but you would know that. And it's because the symbol that you're using here has an implied meaning, has a learned meaning. It's what we call an abstract symbol. It's like a word which has no intrinsic meaning, or at least most words don't. Some words imitate what's happening, like the word crash. Sounds a little bit like a plate breaking or glass breaking. But most words have no intrinsic meaning. They are learned. And many symbols have a learned meaning. I think this is a method applied to perhaps too many things. I sat in a church once in Iowa, which put crosses on everything, including the light fixtures and the pew and all the hymnals. And I sat there and I counted 172 crosses in the building. That was during the sermon. I'll go through the three of these, then we'll come back and talk about different types of each one. Another is the what I call the allegorical symbol, which deals with the transference of the qualities of one object onto another object. And this is something we use all the time. We say, oh, he eats like a pig. You have now involved yourself in an allegory. And this is a way symbols are commonly used. And these can be kind of figured out, you see. These don't have to have strictly a learned meaning. They may have a parochial meaning, which is learned. A specific group may have a certain type of symbol, which is basically allegorical, which they have assigned a meaning to. The use of animal forms is particularly a good example, I think, of this, where we transfer, like eating like a pig, onto people. And in common church or religious or ecclesiastical iconography, you have the symbols of the four evangelists, the four winged creatures from the vision to Ezekiel and repeated in the Gospel according to the Revelation to St. John. You have three creatures described as an ox, a winged ox, a winged lion, an eagle, and a winged man. Well, you're transferring, particularly with the winged man, the angel concept, which is certainly not unique to Christianity. In fact, it isn't particularly Christian at all, or biblical, I should say. Rather, the idea of transferring the bird qualities to man is from the ancient world, particularly the Mesopotamian. If you know anything about Mesopotamian culture, you know they had these winged figures representing the divinities. Even Mercury from the Greeks had wings on his feet. Now, this is to ancient man, who didn't know how to fly, you know, couldn't get on a 727 and zip back to Chicago in 3 hours, flying was a big thing, very impressive. And he saw the bird fly, and he said, oh, the gods are up, you know, in the clouds, and these birds associate with the gods. Therefore, the gods can have these qualities to fly around. And also an attempt to be rational. If you have gods coming and going, you should provide a method for them to move. And, of course, the wings are very handy because they live up there. So this is a transference of the idea of flight onto a human being. And this is a basic idea of an allegorical type of symbol. The third type is the figurative symbol. The physical object with a metaphysical meaning. At no time is the object the object. At no time is a piece of sculpture depicting a human being ever a human being. According to the biblical story of creation, God is the only one that was able to do that. I don't know why this always slips my mind. What is the story about the sculptor who makes the figure and it comes to life? It's Pygmalion. You can make a nice story, as it is in the story of Pygmalion, but only God would be able to do that, to model a man out of clay and breathe into him, and he becomes the real thing. This, of course, is this idolatry we're talking about. But there is such a thing as the figurative symbol. Now, the figurative symbol, let's say in a painting, would, in its most obvious manifestation, would be a man doing something, acting something out. It is the drama, it is the action of being presented that is the communication, that has the meaning. Not the object in itself, but what it communicates. So that a figure can be in a posture of doing something, and this then can have meaning. This is a figurative symbol. Now these can be historically accurate, they can be physiologically accurate, or whatever. The communication comes from the fact that a dramatic portrayal is taking place, an action. And that's the third type of symbol. Now, there are many symbols that have a hard time placing in one of these three categories, but basically, you can define most symbols in these ways, the abstract, the allegorical, and the figurative. One of the symbols that really is a combination of all of these is the halo. Now, that's a common religious symbol. It is not, of course, uniquely Christian. I presume you're aware of that. There's really very little that is unique in Christianity. Most of these things did come from previous sources. Some are, as I said, there's always some symbols being invented, and they go become obsolete. The halo was used, well, in the early Christian art, it was an extension of Roman art. We didn't wake up one morning or at the Edict of Milan and say, all right, now from here on, everything is Christian art, at least up to the end of the so-called Christian era. It doesn't work this way. What it is an extension of Roman art. These were Romans, they thought like Romans, and their art was that of the Romans. And the Romans were, as their Greek predecessors, were humanists. And they did not deal too much with symbolism of an allegorical or abstract type. They were mostly figurative. So this was carried through into the catacombs. But more and more the figures became involved in a hidden meaning. Like the celestial banquet, you have seven people painted on a tomb. You say, well, you know, there were 13 people at the Last Supper. I mean, what's wrong here? Well, what has happened is it's becoming more and more allegorical, because seven is the mystic number of most religions, including Christianity. And I'd have to look it up where that comes from relative to the celestial banquet. It's something to do with the seven great cities or something, I've forgotten. But in any case, this is now representative of the celestial banquet, which alludes to the large supper, but mainly because of its tomb orientation, it refers to the great banquet in the sky, so to speak, the celestial banquet. It becomes a symbol of eternal life. And then this is carried over into the church in terms of becoming a Eucharistic symbol. Also, for the Eucharist, you will have a table, and on it will be bread and fish, not bread and wine, because the fish is a symbol of Christ. They're not too concerned about getting the right instruments on the table any longer. And more the art became symbolic. It would have these other dimensions, other levels of understanding and meaning. And the halo then was introduced too. So, all right, got somebody here that's divine, let's single them out, because in these seven figures sitting at the table, you don't know which one is supposed to be Christ. All right, we have an idea. Well, we'll put a circle around them. I'm going to come back to this hieroglyphics, because much of this is based on hieroglyphics. And a circle is a symbol for life, because of the egg, because of the seed, all these things, these germs of life being contained in circular items. If you can imagine a square egg, you can imagine a chicken who can imagine a square egg. This is the meaning of the circle, but it was indeed a circle. Now, this began to spread out, and the apostles, the disciples had to be singled out too. These are very special people, so they also got a halo. So now we had the problem of distinguishing between Christ and the disciples. So we put a cross in the halo. Now, if you ever see any early Christian art, how you identify the person is not what he looked like. I mean, this is none of the problems of did Christ have a beard or not. He was a rabbi. He probably did. But the Greeks and all early depictions of him did not show a beard, because the Greeks thought wearing a beard was a bad thing. It was more masculine to be clean-shaven. I grew this summer. I don't know what that's supposed to mean. Because I always say I have a strong Old Testament orientation. So this is how you can tell who's who in these paintings. So this is a way of communicating. And then this figure may be doing something, which is a figurative type of treatment or communication. Well, as time went on, well, these became then very flat, very stylized. As time went on, these figures began to loosen up. They began to move in the picture plane. And you have in the early Renaissance a very real problem. What if this figure turned his back on you? So what we have, as in fact we do, like some of the paintings by Giotto, you have the halo sitting on the back of his head like a mortarboard, a gold plate. And this doesn't swing. There is, in fact, there's one painting. It's a deposition, and it's a very profound subject matter. But when you see one of the figures taking down the body of Christ, and his halo is stuck in his armpit, it looks like a very uncomfortable position. You can't help but smile a bit. It was just very hard to resolve this. The man is very ingenious, and he invented a new way. And that was, he put a light bulb inside of the head. And this way he could turn it anywhere he wanted, and it glowed in the dark. And the higher the wattage, the more divinity he had. He really solved the problem. And this is still with us today. Salzman did use the same thing. He has a little light bulb in the head. I think there might be better ways to do this. I don't know. Some way we probably should designate these figures. I have no particular solution, or have any idea what the next step will be. Let's go back and look at then some examples of allegorical symbol, of abstract symbols. This is one that you're very familiar. It's a monogram. The idea is the monogram has always been with us. It is based on the first three letters of the word Christ, C-H-R, would be equivalent to here, Cairo. Now this superimposing of letters becomes, like a monogram on a shirt or a trademark for a company, becomes extremely private. You can't really understand what they're supposed to mean. It doesn't matter, in other words, if you lose this written sequence and superimpose them. Of course, in fact, the chi has been turned to form a cross shape, and you introduce still another level of meaning. You can also add some other things. Any of you know what that symbol means? Yeah, that's right. Christus Rex, or Christ the King. Now here, a Greek monogram has a Latin letter superimposed on it. Of course, the R for Rex. Or, that happens to be the monogram for Jesus and the monogram for Christ and the word Savior, all superimposed. I don't know if I can even take that one apart. Well, here's the H. And here's the I superimposed on the H. And C, which, and those, of course, are letters, the Arabic, for the monogram for Jesus. And then the Cairo, of course, for Christ, and I don't know how to get the other word out of there. Here's one that I think is very, very nice, and it uses Latin letters, which is the same as ours. So it Anyone know what that one is? That is the one you're not going to find in Lutheran churches very often. It's a monogram for Mary, or Maria. And you can take it apart. Here's your M, A, R, and I, and you can rearrange it however way you want. This sign, incidentally, has been frequently confused as an omega. It's not. It's a hieroglyphic for the rising sun. That is, it's the sun rising over the horizon line as a symbol for a new day. And of course, the ancients all believed that every morning the sun was renewed. There's a brand new sun. The Egyptians, you know, believed the sun came up from the places for the afterlife and disappeared over the other side. So a new one had to be born every day. So it became a symbol of regeneration, of resurrection. And this is carried over into even the New Testament. It was symbolically important for Christ to be raised in the morning, sunrise, so that we could identify and understand what was happening. That's why I say, if you appreciate symbolism, it can make the Bible far more meaningful. If you try to make it into something relative to social realism, which we're used to in the 19th and early 20th century, it doesn't make sense, because social realism was not a prevalent philosophy at the time the Bible was written. This then means redemption. Now Mary, of course, maybe doesn't deserve that in our theological point of view, but because she was the mother of our Lord, she is often shown with this symbol and that she was involved in the redemptive act. But frequently you will find the monogram for Jesus with this above it, carved on altars and on hangings. And that's what that means. Well, let's look at hieroglyphics, because that's where this all started. And there is some logic to it. It may be implied meaning, but this is where it all started. You have a horizontal line meaning the earth. This is man. You have a vertical line meaning God, or light, plant, trees, which of course, speaking in terms of God as the creator, you have then a symbol for God, a vertical line. Now, if you put the two together, you have a certain relationship of parts. The tree on the horizon line is a kind of natural relationship. If you take the two and you make them equidistant, from the center, you have an equal relationship of growth to earth, or God to man, and this is what we call a Greek cross. This is common in Egyptian culture. It's adopted by the Christians because it also shows Christ's relationship to man, a total integration of the divine and the human. This is a common one. The triangle, and this is a symbol for woman and a symbol for man. You know, this symbol that's being used for protesting the war is the symbol of a dead male. I wonder if whoever started that knew that. You know, the symbol for the exposition in Montreal was this, and so forth around a circle. Etc. See, this is a male symbol based on the idea of drawing a line to the center of a triangle or continuing this through. So you have this or this. In hieroglyphics, I'm talking about. This is a male. I'll come back to that. This is a male, this is a female. Now there's logic in this too. Male is the stable one. You know, the mother hen looks like a hen. And the male is the unstable figure. But he's the guy that went out and fought the wars. And the wife stayed home and raised the kids and kept the home fires burning. So these became then traditionally male and female symbols. You'll also note that the God symbol, the triangle symbol, is a female symbol, which is a creation symbol. Now let's take two of these and put them together in this kind of position. This would be a platonic relationship. Now let's intertwine them. And you have a procreation symbol. And it's what we call the creator star. In other words, it's a fertility symbol. And a great many of these symbols relate to this, particularly in a society which relied upon this thing for existence, namely that their cattle had to reproduce, and the more they reproduce, the better off they are. The seeds had to grow in order for them to have a good crop. So fertility was a big thing. You know in the Old Testament that if a woman was, they call barren, with a childless, this is a stigma, and this is a bad thing. So many of these symbols are in fact fertility symbols. There's another one with the man and female symbol. Okay, this is man, this is female. Brotherhood, fertility. Put a circle around it for life, and you have a splendid fertility symbol, which Christians adopted to mean Iona Chi, Jesus Christ, the divine. This is a kind of a double meaning. Now, before we run out of time, I better get back to some of these others. The allegorical symbols are very, very common. I think you can think of a good many of these. I want to introduce, well, like, for example, Christ said, I am the vine, you are the branches. Did not mean he was a plant. What he was doing was drawing an allegory between the relationship of the trunk and the branches to the relationship of his people to him. I am the bread of life, he says. I am the light of the world. You have a great many symbols, particularly in the Old Testament, is rich with symbols. And I say I have an Old Testament orientation. I work with symbols, and I find a great many of them there, such as a favorite of mine, Malachi 4:2. Beautiful concept. The sun, S-U-N, the sun of righteousness shall arise with healing in his wings, what I call the winged sun symbol. The rose, Isaiah, I think it was Isaiah, I said, the desert shall blossom as the rose. That was Isaiah, wasn't it? The water of life, these are all allegorical symbols. The idea of fire is a good one, because it has so many dimensions. A fire can be destructive and it can be constructive. It can destroy, but also it brings heat and warmth, and you can cook your food by it. The fire of sacrifice, can be interpreted both destructively and constructively. The sacrificial lamb symbol, the burning bush, the bush that was not consumed, is a beautiful allegory for Christ's crucifixion and resurrection. So you can, if you begin to read these symbols with some understanding of this approach, allegorical approach, you can get all sorts of dimensions from this. But also there is the color spectrum to be used symbolically. And in fact, this is very important in visual presentations. We have, for example, white meaning purity, black meaning death, red meaning zeal, enthusiasm, green meaning growth, and so forth. Now, if you combine some of these symbols, in fact, some that are very commonly used, you can communicate a certain predictive effect. Another allegorical symbol is the rock. The Bible uses the rock symbol frequently. The rock of the church, built on a rock, and so forth, is a very durable thing. Raising an altar means piling some rocks together to mark the place. In fact, one of the trail symbols we use is rocks piled. And remember, Jacob piled rocks to mark the place. He said, this is Bethel, and he piled a bunch of rocks up. The rock is a symbol of durability, of permanence to us. So let's combine several symbols. Let's take the square. Now, the square has four equal sides. It is a stable figure. It's not going anywhere. It's very stable. Let's add a rock, and let's add the color white for purity or honesty, and you have the basic ingredients of most designs of banks. They're beginning to get away from this now, but it's amazing that how strong this tradition is, that all banks must be very square, all banks must be light in color to suggest their honesty, and all banks are made of stone or granite. So this is something that's happening all the time, all around us, if we recognize it. It can either become meaningless or in some cases a little ridiculous, and maybe it should be discarded. I wanted to leave just a few minutes for any questions or any symbols that you would like to bring up. So I'll close in formal presentation with just a statement about figurative painting again, although really we've rather talked about that right along, that the meaning in any work of art is not intrinsic in the figure, but in the action of the figure, with the exception of portrait painting. The portrait painting, for the most part, does not communicate an idea. It is a description of a person, and the camera has largely usurped the role of the painter as a recorder of history. Some are still being done, particularly for college presidents. They almost have their portrait painted. In fact, the president at POU had a formal portrait taken, photograph, and no one seemed to be satisfied with it. It just you know, ain't right. It's got to have a portrait painted. Well, that's about the only people that have portraits painted anymore, because the camera has pretty well taken the place of the painter. So with that exception, when you see figurative work, you should understand its basic communication is in the action or in the drama of the work and not in the figure itself. So in the case of Christ, of figures of Christ, what is he doing? And there is a reproduction of a Rembrandt etching over in Koinonia, where Christ is involved in something. And of course, Rembrandt is the great master, and maybe the lesson should be taken here. I'm glad to see that, because so frequently churches want to get involved in personality cults, and they'll ignore the great masters like Rembrandt, and instead buy things like by Salzman or Hoffman, whose work is, of course, far below that of Rembrandt's. And the main difference, though, is Rembrandt produced the drama of the incident. Salzman and Hoffman produced the sentiment and the sentimental aspect of it. And of course, this involvement with personality. So I'm not going to get involved in talking about individual works without having the possibility here of showing them to you, but at least I hope this is an introduction or reintroduction to that aspect of art also, the figurative. Now, any of you would like to raise any question or to throw out a symbol in terms of what it might mean? Is, yes?
Going back to the figures on the tomb here, wouldn't these figures oftentimes maybe be the actual self-portraits that you have a group of individuals who were involved in that?
The Romans liked portraiture, you're right there. I mean, that's a good thing to bring up as I talked about it. So many of these things were, in fact, portraits, that's true. But even if they were portraits, they were grouped in certain symbolic numbers and put in certain contexts. I think it might be well to describe, I designed the symbol on the banner, describe what this means too, but there was someone else that had a question here first. Yes. No, I said I would avoid it because it was too long to get into. Well, yes, basically a sign is, it points a direction to something rather than to have a levels of meaning. But an arrow would be a sign rather than a symbol. But it's deeper than that. Words are basically signs and signals rather than symbols. Yes.
And I expect to take it back to Los Angeles when I go back. I have it up in my room and I've decorated the altar. I'm in room number 6 above the dining hall. It's open locked. I invite any of you who are interested in symbolism to go up anytime you wish and take a look. See what you see. See something you like, tell me. See something you don't like, tell me.
Fine. Let's look at the banner so we don't miss this. I've been asked by several people precisely what it means. Oh, didn't get over far enough. Ran into the microphone. Actually, on the sweatshirts, whoever adapted the symbol changed its meaning. I shouldn't have mentioned that. Destroy it for somebody. But it's very important that every part have something to say and have some relevance to the total concept, or it becomes in sheer decoration. It loses its meaning. And I don't want to get involved in decoration. But the basic symbol here related to the surroundings, which I thought it illustrated creation amply, by sheer scale and scope, and I felt anything that was done along this line probably should tie in on this level. And perhaps maybe man has separated himself from what we call nature at least too much, that he lives in an asphalt world. I'm very much interested in creation symbols, even so far as agricultural type symbols, because I think at least the idea is still with us, even though very few people work in agriculture anymore. This is a creation symbol. It is not specifically Christian or even specifically religious. This is a conclusion that you have to draw. You have to interpret based on your experience. What is shown here is a single living organism or plant, and this is what was changed and when it was adapted, from a single stem. And I tell you, I could have made this more explicit by putting roots on the stem. So it was in part my fault, perhaps. But there's a single stem here in which two branches spread out. One is a dead branch with a thorny branch, and the other is a living branch bearing fruit. And this is a symbol of nature, that you always have, where you have life and fruit, you always have death. You can never separate the two. And a real classic example in the Northwest is the nurse log. If any of you don't know what this is, other part of the country, when these large trees die and fall, the little tree springing up will feed on it, and they'll grow in a line. I didn't see too many out here. Doesn't that happen in this part of the country, east of the east side? Oh, I didn't see any, but in the lush rainforest of the Olympic Peninsula, it's very, very common. You see all these trees in lines, in straight lines. They feed off of it. But a plant going to seed dies. And here we have Christ dying to give life. To me, this is a creation symbol. That's not implicit here, except that it's a thorn. So there is a suggestion here that we're talking about or referring to the crown of thorns, that to give life and to bear fruit is to die, to be totally committed to whatever you're doing, would be an application that I would make. But basically, then, it's the dead branch, the thorny branch, and the live branch bearing fruit. And of course, the fact they're grapes suggest a Eucharistic connotation, which again is a parochial treatment. The sunburst, and you could treat this as a winged sun too if you wanted to. If any of you knew a lot about my work, you would recognize this in fact as a private symbol, because this is in fact part of a general symbol that I've worked up based on the winged sun. Tonight I'll be talking about my own work, and I do a lot of things with symbols. But even if you didn't recognize this as a Christocentric symbol, you could still see it as a natural phenomenon of the sun, which is the origin of life-giving energy, which is outside of the plant. So the plant gets its energy from this other source. And so this analogy can be made then for man, it can be made for the church, it can be made for nature or creation, whatever you want to. But this was the intention of the symbol. Now, where it was buried was that the dead branch was taken off of it was pruned. Maybe that's a symbol of the modern church. We keep pruning the commitment out of our religion. We keep taking the crucifixion out of our religion we end up with sweetness and life on Sunday, Easter morning. And that's no religion. And doesn't require anything of you. All right, anybody else want to make a comment before we close? No, I think that's a literary allegory you could draw, perhaps, in relationship with the sun, the flaming sun to the bush, but I think it'd be stretching this symbol a bit. I think you could have done this. I think an equally effective symbol, if this is effective for Holden Village, would be perhaps the burning bush, the bush that's not consumed. And maybe that bush could also bear fruit while it's being inflamed. You could draw all sorts of applications here.
Yes.
Well, certainly this could be taken too, and that would be you would do that only because you knew about the verbal or the literary reference. Yes. Oh, they took the dead branch off and made it a separate entity, and then the fruit bearing branch is separate. The two aren't together anymore. Well, this just raises a problem. Generally speaking, no. I just noticed that Daystar plagiarized me again. I was in Chalet 1 and noticed they copped a design I did for a Walterly convention a number of years ago without my permission. If you're going to cop something more or less accurately, you should at least get permission of the artist. Daystar has done this on one other occasion. I would rather, like in this Christmas card, based on this design, I did not do that. It isn't the way I would have done it. I would say that should have, instead of giving me credit, should have been based on a design by, these are minor problems dealing with my ego. Yes. Well, this is a whole another problem. I don't think there's anything original, really. We just rearrange things, and how we rearrange it can make it pertinent and make it important. But generally speaking, I don't consider this a real possibility to be original. But the way things are put together may be somewhat unique. Okay. I think our hour has passed. I would very much enjoy the dialogue developing, but I think there is something else happening very soon. So thank you for your attention.